Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Quick peek behind the curtain. It is Friday as we record this, and all three of us are really looking forward to the weekend. Hi, I'm Ben.
Hi, I'm Noel, and double peek behind the curtain. This is take two of starting this episode. The first time around, I said that my name was Ben, and you had said that we were very excited to be here. I was going to say I'm very exhausted, but still excited to be here. But then I called myself you. I don't know if that's some kind of like Freudian thing or what, but I am happy to be here and happy to see you.
I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy to see you as well, Noel. The same goes for our super producer, Casey Pegram. Quick question for you, Casey. Have you ever been in a hot air balloon?
Never, no.
What about you, Noel?
No, it seems utterly terrifying to me.
I have also never, as far as I know, been in a hot air balloon. So if I ever was, I must have been a wee tyke. But they are one of my favorite of ridiculous human inventions. Can you just imagine the cartoonish audacity of it? Someone said, well, we'll just, you know, get up there and see how it goes from there. Hot air balloons, aside from being, you know, visually stunning and inspiring, are also a passion of many, many people. In fact, before we went on the air today, we're looking into this, and I found no less than 3 hot air balloon festivals going on here in our fair state of Georgia. So this is my pitch. Noel, Casey, do you guys want to go on a hot air balloon with me?
We could become Ridiculous History, the podcast of the air.
There we go. And some people, perhaps Sheryl Crow included, would say that we have enough hot air already.
Eh? God, she is just the worst, man.
She's really dogging us, man.
Why, dude?
I don't know.
What did we ever do to Sheryl?
Just complimented the bongos, you
know?
That's
what I always do. I really do think that's a very important moment in American music.
Agreed, my friend. We want to hear about the hot air balloon experiences in your life or the festivals in your neck of the global woods. And we'll keep you guys updated over the summer if any of us or all of us make it to one of those. But today's story is not about the fun, high-altitude hijinks of touring the air in a hot air balloon. No, it is about balloons as weapons.
Yeah, I mean, when we think of aerial attacks against the United States, the first thing, obviously, that comes to mind, and for many, the only thing that comes to mind, are the tragic events of Pearl Harbor on December 7th of 1941, when Japanese forces mounted a bombing raid on Pearl Harbor, kicking off the events of World War II on September 9th of 1942. But it turns out, Ben, that is not the only air attack on American soil.
You're absolutely right. It turns out that one of the most unusual attacks on American soil occurred during World War II, and it was a balloon attack, or it would be more accurate to say a balloon bombing. You see, the Japanese army employed balloon bombs, or as they were called, Fugos, F-U-G-O-S. Starting in 1944, the Japanese military constructed and launched over 9,000 high-altitude balloons, and these each were loaded with 50 pounds of explosives.
That's right, Ben. So the Japanese Military Scientific Laboratory actually came up with the idea of what they referred to as Fusen Bakuden, or balloon bombs, back in 1933. And the Fugo that you mentioned, Ben, or these balloon bombs, were just one of several ideas that were proposed by this research unit. And there is a fantastic scholarly report in the Smithsonian Annals of Flight by Robert C. Mikus that's kind of the definitive work on this. And it's pretty crazy. Some of the ideas they didn't go with are even more ridiculous. There's one called a death ray. Mm-hmm. And the idea there was it was going to be balloon driven. It would shoot like electric rays or like, you know, electric bolts at people on the ground. It would like hover low. And then there were several other versions of what became the Fugos. Lieutenant General Raikichi Tada of the Japanese Military Scientific Laboratory is the one who was assigned to this program. And he developed several pretty out there ideas that were already in the works. One of them was the Igo weapon, which was a wire controlled tank that could attack enemy positions. And then there was the Rogo weapon, which was a rocket propelled weapon. And then you had what I mentioned earlier, the death ray that would kill enemies up close with this electric charge. But the one that seemed like it was going to be a winner out of these, the one they wanted to take all the way, was the Fugo weapon, which was an altitude controlled balloon. In terms of, when I say altitude controlled, I mean there was a barometric valve that would act according to the elevation, according to how the altitude of the balloon, and it would drop sandbags if it went too high, and then it would change the amount of air that was in the balloon when it went too low. And the idea was it had a fuse that would ignite once the wind currents carried the balloon close to the American coast, and the idea was to wreak havoc and chaos on America's Pacific Northwest region specifically, by causing forest fires. These incendiary devices would deploy when the fuse would burn up, and it was meant to not necessarily cause any kind of real infrastructure damage, but just kind of cause chaos and mass confusion.
Yeah, and, you know, we can totally understand how this pitch sounds crazy at first blush, but a little bit of a historical context will help us realize that this is kind of a brilliant idea. This is not the first time balloons were weaponized. During the Italian War of Independence from 1848 to 1849, Austrian Lieutenant Eucatus undertook the technical development of balloons that could be used as bombs. So there was historical precedent. And the thing was, no one had quite pulled it off as successfully as the Japanese military would hope. Let's talk just a little bit about these balloons. As described by J. David Rogers of the Missouri University of Science and Technology, these balloon bombs were 33 feet in diameter, and they could lift about 1,000 pounds. But the deadly portion of the cargo, again, was this 33-pound anti-personnel fragmentation bomb. And it was attached to that fuse you mentioned, NOLA 64, foot long fuse that was intended to burn for exactly 82 minutes before detonating. And despite the fact that these are weapons of war, you have to appreciate the aesthetic. These balloons were made of rubberized silk or paper, and they were handmade. These were glued together. Now, one of the things that we, not being hot air balloon experts, have always wondered, alone and together here on the show, is how exactly you steer a hot air balloon. Because on the offset, it seems tough. You would want like a fan up there maybe to provide some sort of propulsion or to function, you know, more or less as a rudder. For the Japanese military, the goal here was kind of a spaghetti at the wall approach. They decided that quantity was a quality all its own. And so they released an estimated 9,000 of these balloons. So far as we know, at least 342 reached the U.S., and some even got as far as Nebraska. But what was their attrition rate? Were they actually causing harm?
No. No, because they couldn't be steered. And the technology or the idea behind them is they would travel on these winter jet streams for an average of 60 hours to reach America. And like you said, they greenlit through this project after realizing that there was a potential for success, about 10,000, between 9 and 10,000 of these balloons. And they were handmade, Ben, by school children. By young schoolgirls from a neighboring school to the site of this project, and it took 30 men about 30 minutes to an hour to prepare each of these balloons for flight. And let's remember, these were unmanned balloons. These were meant to be autonomous and to behave in certain ways depending on the altitude, and just hope that they would get to their target. And the fact of the matter is they were launched on the birthday of the former emperor Meiji, and that is when the first series of launches took place. And despite the project being top secret, they were not very inconspicuous. They were spotted. They were described as looking like clusters of jellyfish in the sky.
Absolutely, because if you look at the picture, you've got this 33-foot diameter balloon, right? And then you've got this fuse going down, and the stuff that it's carrying, it looks like a large version of Snappin' Pops. Do you guys remember those, the little paper bags that you would throw and they would have a pop?
Yeah, with a tiny little, you know, like piece paper of paper fuse at the top, the
twist. It looks very similar to that, or maybe tea bags wrapped in twine. The thing is that although they launched thousands and thousands of these balloons, they didn't cause the level of havoc that the Japanese military hoped they would create. They did have some damaging psychological effects, because you look up in the sky and there's this balloon invasion that's unexplained. And the amazing thing is that they made it across the Pacific at all. They were launched from Japan to the U.S. and into Canada, and that trip took several days, again, with no one on board, no one steering. And here's one of the problems. The U.S. reacted in a very strange way. 2 days after the initial launch, there's a Navy patrol off the coast of California, and they see some tattered cloth in the sea. They retrieve it, and they notice that it has Japanese characters on it. They alert the FBI, and then 2 weeks later, more sea debris of balloons that didn't make the journey are found, and the military started putting together the puzzle pieces. They said something is up, and then over the next 4 weeks, reports of balloons started coming in from all across the western half of North America, and every day American citizens began seeing these tattered pieces of cloth or hearing explosions in the distance.
In 1944, December 1944, workers at a coal mine that was near Thermopolis, Wyoming, described seeing a, quote, parachute in the air with lighted flares. And after hearing a whistling noise, that's when they heard the sound of an explosion and they saw smoke very near the mine.
And the military immediately freaks out about this, but initially they are not worried about explosives being carried by balloons. Some of the folks in the military on the U.S. side are concerned that these balloons may carry something potentially far more dangerous than explosives. They are concerned that these balloons may carry biological weapons. And they thought maybe the balloons were being launched from the Japanese relocation or internment camps that existed at the time, or German POW camps. And it wasn't until later in December of 1944 a military intelligence project was put together to evaluate and collect various evidence of these balloon sites. And they figured out they were coming from Japan, not just made by Japanese forces, but coming from Japan, when they looked into a ballast and found that the sand inside the ballast was from a beach in the south of Japan. And they realized that these were meant to carry explosives. And the problem with those explosives is that they could pose a huge danger to the forest of the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, that's right, because it's very dry in the winter, and these forest fires could really spread and cause some serious havoc. And that was exactly what the Japanese had in mind. Again, they weren't thinking this was going to, you know, put a real dent militarily in the U.S. forces, but it would cause some panic and be pretty inconvenient. But the military pretty quickly realized that these weren't very precision targeted, that they were pretty aimless. And even though they realized that they were not going to be very successful, as we heard from the folks that reported from the coal mine, it kind of blew up in midair and didn't actually cause any damage. It just kind of freaked them out. The military did not warn the public. They kept it very top secret, and they did their investigation into it, like you described, but they didn't put out any kind of notice. So people were still seeing these clusters of weird floating jellyfish and didn't know what the hell was going on.
Was it a UFO? Was it an errant domestic hobbyist? What was that smoke in the distance? Did you also hear that explosion? It was, with the benefit of retrospect, we can say the U.S. military took the wrong course of action when they decided to stay silent, because in the when there's no transparency, speculation thrives. But their logic did make sense at the time, because they didn't want the Japanese forces to get a morale boost from hearing anything about this operation being a success. The Office of Censorship went so far as to instruct newspapers and radio stations not to discuss the balloons in print or on air. And they made that decree on January 4th of 1945. And the Japanese only heard about one balloon incident on the North American continent, and that was through a Chinese newspaper. Now, as innovative and unsuccessful as this plan may sound, the unfortunate truth is that they did cause some fatalities.
Yeah, that's the thing. They kept the U.S. military kept this thing under pretty tight wraps until an incident occurred that actually did cause some casualties. Now, Japanese Domei News Agency was reporting on February 17th of 1945 that this had been a success. And this is a propaganda paper, and it was really, really, really inflating the numbers, saying that between 500 and 10,000 casualties occurred. But here's the reality. It was actually six casualties, and they were historically the only casualties on American soil for World War II, which is crazy because you'd think you would have heard of this, and I had never heard of this until we looked into it.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened?
So this takes place in Bly, Oregon. It was a Sunday school picnic. They approached the mysterious debris of one of these balloons. A fellow named Reverend Archie Mitchell was about to yell a warning to the kids when the balloon exploded. Sherman Shoemaker, Edward Ingen, Jay Gifford, Joan Patsky, and Dick Patsky were all killed. And these were children. They were 11 to 14 years old. The Reverend's wife, Elsie Mitchell, also died, and she was 5 months pregnant. This tragedy is what caused the U.S. military to finally break its silence and its suppression of the story. And so they began issuing warnings not to tamper with anything that looked remotely like one of these balloons.
Because let's just backtrack slightly. This balloon wasn't deployed properly. It's not like it fell on them. It was already
on the ground.
And like basically this woman, when she pulled the family car pulled over because she was feeling some morning sickness, and she discovered this bundle of stuff that looked kind of like paper, like almost like origami paper or something like that, and thought it was neat looking. And they started poking at it or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. And she said, "Look what I found, dear." According to the Mail Tribune, a newspaper in Southern Oregon, there's a great article you can read about this from David Kravitz writing on Wired, May 5th, 1945, Japanese balloon bomb kills six in Oregon. So it left these innocent people dead in a horrific scene. They didn't all die immediately. Joan Patsky died minutes after being seriously injured. There was a 1 foot hole in the ground. And although they were, as you said, Noel, the only known casualties of this operation, the U.S. government didn't want to take any chances. So they issued, you know, they started warning people not to mess with these things. They also, at the same time, somewhat counterintuitively or paradoxically, emphasized that the balloons did not represent a serious threat. And they said, just report these. Just let us know if you see them. We'll send someone to take care of them. And that led to, you know, as we said, 300 to 342 incidents being recorded with various parts recovered, but no lives lost. They did, however, have a very close call with infrastructure.
Yeah, one of them hit a power line and caused a blackout at a weapons facility in Hanford, Washington, a nuclear weapons facility. That could have gone a lot worse than it did.
According to Colonel Franklin Matthias, the Hanford plant did lose about 2 days of production, but he thought, as he recalls at least, he says, We were all tickled to death that this happened because it proved our backup system worked as far as keeping everything stable when they lose the power. And another guy there, Vincent Bud Whitehead, who is a counterintelligence agency at Hanford, recalled chasing and bringing down another balloon, and he was chasing it from a small airplane. Get this. This is crazy. This is what he literally did. He says, I threw a brick at it. I put a hole in it, and it went down. I got out there, and I started tromping all over that thing and got all the gas out of it. I radioed in that I had found it and got it. They sent a bus up with all the specially trained personnel, gloves, full of contamination suits, masks. I had been walking around on that stuff, and they had not told me that they were afraid of bacterial warfare.
Jeez.
I know.
I want to do a quick correction. It wasn't – the balloon didn't hit the Hanford site. It hit the Bonneville Power Administration in Washington, which supplied power to the Hanford site. That was one of the biggest consumers of power from that particular grid. And so that could have caused some major problems.
Mm-hmm. And so balloon sightings continued throughout the years. It's interesting because you know how these kind of things can take over a country's – collective attention span, right? Just after the war, reports continued to come in from far and wide about balloon incidents. The Beatrice Daily Sun reports them over 7 different towns in Nebraska, including Omaha. The Winnipeg Tribune notes that there's a balloon bomb found 10 miles from Detroit, one near Grand Rapids. They were still finding balloon bombs as far as like the mid-1950s.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, these were like artifacts at this point, right? They were exploded already, or maybe they didn't go off properly, and they were scattered because, I mean, that's 10,000 that were deployed with various that ended up scattered all over the country. I think they made it as far as Michigan, I want to say, right?
Yeah, they made it as far as Michigan.
Hawaii, even.
Mm-hmm. And Alaska. I believe it was in January of 1955, the Albuquerque Journal reports that the U.S. Air Force discovered a balloon in Alaska in 1955. And then in 1944, looking back, an outfit called the Santa Cruz Sentinel noted that a fellow named Bert Weber, who was an author and a researcher, had found 45 different balloon bombs in Oregon, 37 in Alaska, 28 in Washington, and 25 in California. And reports still continue to pour in. There was one found in October of 2014.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. In British Columbia, according to Henry Prose of the RCMP, or Royal Canadian Mounted Police, this balloon had been in the dirt for 70 years, and he said it would have been way too dangerous to move it. So it's possible that someone found it in the intervening decades and just decided to let sleeping dogs lie.
So in other words, they didn't work. They were duds, right? Like the fuse didn't ignite properly, and then they just went down, and there was no boom.
But still, if you mess with it, you know what I mean? You could cause it to explode.
I don't think we found this, Ben, but what was the material? I know the balloons were hydrogen balloons, so that could have even aided in the spreading of the fire, because that's highly flammable, like in Hindenburg and all that. But what was the material that the explosives were made of?
Incendiary bomb is kind of a genre of bomb. It can include stuff like napalm, magnesium powder, white phosphorus. These used thermite. And thermite how did you say, Noel? Did it occur in Breaking Bad?
Yeah, there's one of those MacGyver kind of moments in Breaking Bad where I think he uses an Etch-a-Sketch or like the iron filings in an Etch-a-Sketch to create thermite or to make a reaction that produces this explosion.
Yeah, thermite is a mixture of finely powdered aluminum and iron oxide. It creates a really high temperature on combustion, and it's often used in welding and for incendiary bombs. So this is dangerous stuff. And in 2014, when the RCMP found this, you know, this ancient bomb, they handled it by putting C4 explosives on either side of the thing and blowing it to smithereens.
And thermite burns so hot that it can, as it was used in that scene in Breaking Bad, melt metal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, it's a biggie.
It's nothing to play with. It's interesting because we have to consider how much of this plan and how much of the fallout of it hinged purely on chance. You know what I mean?
Well, that's the thing we talked about earlier at the top of the show. There's really no way, even if you're manning a balloon or you're piloting a balloon, you're kind of just able to go up and down. I mean, we talked off air about how a Zeppelin or a blimp is a more or less a steerable hot air balloon
right, because
it's more streamlined and it moves in a forward direction, right? And it's got like a fan system. But this kind of balloon really can only go up and down. And as we described earlier, it was a kind of altitude-controlled system. I believe I said it the other way around earlier in the show, so I just want to correct myself there. If it was going too high, then hydrogen would be released from the balloon, and if it was going too low, then sandbags would be deployed. And it was all this kind of valve that was controlled, like, barometrically.
To keep it at a more or less consistent altitude.
In order to have the most consistent path, because it was being, you know, pushed along by these winter jet streams. But once you let them go, there's just no precision. It's like the episode we did on the bat bombs. Remember that, Ben?
Yeah.
Very similar.
Yeah.
Where they had to be deployed automatically using very similar mechanisms, I imagine, or I believe. And those were a big old mess, too. And didn't we used those against the Japanese. Remember?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we dropped them on Japanese villages because the houses were made of wood and paper and stuff. Yeah. And they would potentially burn the houses, right?
Yeah. Well, not you and I specifically.
No, the bats would. The bats would nest in the eaves, and then they had timers that would then eventually set off the devices. But that was a big flop, too.
That's the thing about innovation. It's always risky. Let's talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of how this thing actually exploded. Like, what triggers the bomb?
Well, there were a couple of different types of ordnance, or payload is the military term, that they used. I think most of them used thermite, but they were just different sizes, and there were different ones that had slightly different mechanisms.
Yeah, anti-personnel and incendiary.
That's right, exactly. But the incendiary device that I think was most common had a fuse that gets armed during flight, and then when it's dropped on impact, there's a magazine that's fired, which then ignites a black powder charge. It's much like the way a pistol works, right? Mm-hmm. And then that, in turn, ignites a central channel that contains another charge, and then the incendiary material, and there are these different pots that have more black powder charge, and then the explosive force of those reactions, that chain reaction, that triggers the thermite, and then the body of the bomb actually erupts. It's enough to, because it's made of metal.
Right. And so we see the logic. We see how this could work, and we see the primary flaw in the plan, the reliance on chance, right, on who fortune favors that day. And this speaks to the desperate state of the war, you know, and the desperate state of the Japanese military at the time. While weaponized balloons did not work out for the Japanese military in World War II, that doesn't mean that our species has given up all hope of weaponizing balloons. In fact, we're still, as a species, developing weaponized balloons today. The United States Department of Defense Missile Defense Agency contracted Lockheed Martin to construct what they called a high-altitude airship, or HA for short, for part of its ballistic missile defense system. This thing is unmanned. It is supposed to operate at a height of over 60,000 feet or 18,000 meters in a quasi-geostationary position to be a surveillance aircraft, to relay telecommunications, and to observe weather. Pretty crazy stuff, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I think the way balloons are used mostly today is for observing weather. And then I think remember the Googaloon project?
I love the name.
Yeah, it was a way to deploy wireless internet connectivity
in rural areas.
And it was literally like some sort of broadcast device that was attached to a balloon that could then hover over like these areas and they could like get Wi-Fi that way.
Man, I love blimps and balloons so much. I get that they're silly. A few years ago, our pal Scott Benjamin and I got really close to getting into a Goodyear blimp. And the more I think about it, you know, the only reason we don't have more blimps now is because someone would be a jerk and attack them or blow them up. Why can't we have nice things? Why can't I have a blimp?
I know. And I'll tell you this. I tell you, I would not want to ride in a basket on a hot air balloon, but I'd be totally cool with riding in a blimp in style.
Right? It's just a bigger basket.
First class for me, baby.
Right, like in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Remember? He hops on an airship.
Oh, yeah. Airships are so cool because they're so ominous and so slow-moving, and they have this kind of, like, doom bringer kind of quality to them, you know? And they make me think of, like, Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow.
Oh, there we go.
This kind of, like, idea of, like, a weird steampunky kind of future, you know?
Angelina Jolie with an eye patch, right?
Oh, yeah.
Eye patches are so cool.
Her eye patch didn't have a string, though. It just kind of, like, stuck there.
Yeah, it was just the patch.
Because of the future, you know?
Because of the retro future. Well, Noel, while I'm candidly a little bit let down, poor choice of words, that you don't want to go in a hot air balloon, I totally understand where you're coming from. And I would ride in a blimp with you. Casey Pegram, would you ride in a hot air balloon? You know, if I had a hot air balloon handy and we could be like up and back down pretty soon, would you hop on?
I'll consider it.
What if there was a guarantee that we would take you to the land of Oz?
I'll consider it.
Okay.
By which we mean Australia.
Exactly. The land of Aussies.
So let us know what you think. Let us know about your balloon experiences. Let us know if you would be in a hot air balloon. And, you know, honestly, we just have to shoot our shot at some point. There's no harm in asking, do you have a blimp? Do you have access to a blimp? Because we would love to hang out with you on your blimp.
That would be a pretty baller vehicle to own. Only the elitist of the elite can own a blimp.
It's such a unless it's one of those high altitude surveillance platforms, it feels like any private citizen who just says, I want a blimp, is buying this billionaire's toy.
So I'm saying, if you have a blimp, you also have to have like a hangar. A blimp-sized hangar, right. Or some way to tether it to, like, the top of your, you know, skyscraper or whatever.
It would be so cool to be in a blimp.
It would be pretty cool. We did an episode on blimps that was made of pigskin or something like that, or it was made of, you know, some organic material. And I believe there was a time where they were – infrastructure was being put in place to, like, stow blimps, and they were literally tethered to the tops of buildings.
Yes, that is correct.
And they could get into them – that way. Like they would like lower down ladders. I don't remember exactly how it worked. But.
And if you want to learn more about airships, dirigibles, hot air balloons, and blimps, you can check out some old car stuff episodes. It's early in our respective careers, so do be kind. But yes, please let us know about your airship and balloon adventures. You can find us on our Facebook group, Ridiculous Historians, where you can meet our favorite part of the show, your fellow listeners. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram, either as our show or Dramatic Pause as ourselves.
Individually, I am at Embryonic Insider.
I am at Ben Bolin. Also, massive thanks, as always, to super producer Casey Pegram.
As always, big thanks to our research associate Gabe Luzier, Alex Williams, who composed our theme, our dear friend in spirit here with us now, Christopher Hasiotis. And you, Ben, I'd like to thank you for just being such a dapper young lad with a heart of gold and a fine head of hair.
Well, thank you, Noel. I appreciate that. And likewise to you, you've got a killer hat on. I've been admiring your gorilla hat. For anyone who doesn't know, my friend here is a big fan of ball caps and has quite a collection. And I got to tell you, man, I appreciate that compliment because I'm feeling a little under the weather today. I'm kind of slumming it. I'm wearing jeans.
Oh, I can't see them because they're underneath the table. From where I sit, you look like a fine, strapping young lad.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I wonder where the phrase strapping came from to describe someone as fit and capable. Story for another time.
I think so. I think we should explore it on another episode of Ridiculous History. We'll see you next time. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.